before we get into the heart of the matter, I should probably tell you a little bit about myself. I'm the oldest son of a large family and had spent my entire life in the same town in the Northeast United States. Forgive me for being evasive, but I have to be rather discreet about certain locations that I feature in my story. I've also changed the names of people involved so as to protect the innocent and avoid libel suits from the families of the not-so-innocent. We lived in a very small house on the edge of a forest and across the street from an abandoned rock quarry. I was also very active in the Boy Scouts. The isolation of my home and the various strange places my Boy Scout troop traveled resulted in more than one unsettling run-in with dangerous animals, whether they walked on four legs or two. So over the years, I developed a bit of a danger sense. Whenever I detected something about a situation was a little off, all the hairs on my arms and the back of my neck would spring to attention. Most of the time, this danger sense was a false alarm. I soon came to hate deer, but every once in a while, it gave me good advice to keep me from blundering into bears, rabid coyotes, pot farmers, and one I suspect to have been a serial killer. There were also a few stranger incidents, but those are best left for another time. In short, I learned to be grateful for my subconscious. As I got to the end of my high school career, I became eager to get out of the house and go to college. I loved my family dearly, but I was more than ready to be known as an individual rather than as a small part of a collective. I was also very socially awkward, particularly when it came to women. I was looking forward to the blank slate that going away to college would provide. As my senior year drew to a close, I came across the campus that features into my story. Once again, I'm going to have to fudge the geography a bit, so I'll limit myself to saying that it was a relatively small school somewhere in Ohio. From the moment I set foot on campus, the cheerfulness of the students infected me like nothing else had in a long time. The other students' enthusiasm for life in general was the main reason that I chose to go here rather than to a more inexpensive state school. I know some would say that it was a waste of money to pick which college to attend to on such details, but I still hold that there's more to attending college than academics. I decided to be an English major, and off I went. My number of friends multiplied unbelievably fast in those first few weeks, and the three that became my best friends were Nick, Topher, and Robin. Robin was very emotional and was all heart with very little head. Nick and Topher were more logical, like me, although with Topher, this made him rather eccentric and not that good with relating to other people. He was more happy blowing up stuff in the woods and hunting deer than talking to people. Nick was also an English major. We spent many nights staying up late discussing the Lord of the Rings or classical mythology. During those first few weeks, I also met Emily. She was, in my opinion, the most beautiful woman on the earth. She had eyes as blue as the sky on a cloudless day, and her light brown wavy hair brought back fond memories of the forests and early spring finally coming to life again after a long winter. Her smile could light up the room, and her laugh was better than sunshine after a rainstorm. Not only was she beautiful, she was also one of the smartest and kindest people that I'd ever known. Our philosophical discussions inside and outside the classroom usually left me with my head spinning, and yet she displayed an optimistic view about human nature that made it impossible for anyone to be pessimistic around her. I also had less of a problem with my social awkwardness around her. I may have had a hard time talking to girls, but Emily talked more than enough for the both of us. I wish I could say that I immediately swept her off her feet and we eloped the following summer, but that sadly was not the case. I was still awkward around women, and for the longest time I had to settle for the position of just being a friend. But I digress. You all came to this story looking for a scary one, and it is high time that I started to deliver. As I mentioned, the students on our campus were perpetually cheerful. As time went on, my fellow freshmen and I began to hear stories that suggested there was a karmic price for this happiness. Most of the time, the sun was shining, life was good, but Once the warm days of late summer went away and the shadows began to grow longer and take on sinister appearances, we began to see a different side of the campus. There were stories. At the time, I was pretty sure that the stories were just attempts by the upperclassmen to scare the gullible freshmen, but during my years living on campus, I've seen enough weird stuff to begin to wonder. There were the shadow men who walked the hallways of the dorms on stormy nights and stood at the foot of students' bed. There were the mysterious crying sounds of a baby in the student center in the dead of night. There was the wolf creature that sometimes roamed the classroom buildings and was reputed to have chased one of the campus security guards through the stacks in the library before vanishing into thin air. And finally, there were the skulls. In order to understand what I'm about to tell you about the skulls, you have to understand the layout of one of our classroom buildings. Our drama and history departments have only a handful of students and are therefore regarded as the red-headed stepchildren of the various majors offered on campus. As a result, both of them are tucked away in the basement of one of our classroom buildings, Edward Hall. The theater where the drama department performed their plays was tucked away in the far corner of Edward's basement. The only entrances or exits from the theater were the main entrance, which was where the tickets were sold and collected, and a staircase behind the stage, which most people didn't even know existed. Right next to the theater was the storage closet that was shared between the drama department and the history department. I rarely saw the inside of the closet, but I was more than happy to stay away from it. The various prop weapons laying everywhere unnerved me, and there was a strange idol in the very back the room, which seemed to always be watching you, no matter where you stood. If you came into the door, the idol was sitting on its pedestal watching you. If you were working in the shelves, you could usually see some part of the blasted thing over an aisle maintaining its silent vigil. The campus legend said that the idol was found in an Aztec temple many years ago with the skulls at its feet. Most historians bemoan the fact that Cortez dismantled a good portion of their Aztec culture when he showed up with the Spanish forces. I, however, have always had a quiet admiration for the man. When I looked up the Aztecs online and saw all the human sacrifices and cannibalism that they embraced, I became secretly convinced that Cortez had done the world a favor. I was not the only one who feared the idol. I once heard two of the professors talk in hushed whispers about destroying it. They eventually decided not to do so because, as they said, at least now we know the genie is still in the lamp. In order to reach the theater, you'd have to come down the main staircase, which brought you right past the skulls. There were four of them, kept in a glass case, just as you have doubtless seen in dozens of museums. Being a logical person, I was irritated by my irrational fear of the skull. Something about them set my danger sense off every time I walked past them. Their hollow eye sockets seemed to turn to follow me as I walked past, even though I knew that to be impossible. Most unsettling of all was what would occur every long once in a while when I had to walk past the skulls alone. On those occasions, I could swear that I heard a very faint sound, click-clack, click-clack. My overactive imagination immediately assumed that it was the sound of the bones grinding against each other. Needless to say, I did not go into the basement of Edward unless I had a very good reason. The urban legends of the campus were a favorite late-night discussion among my group of friends, and we all had different opinions on the various stories. Topher and I were in agreement that most of the stories were probably exaggerated beyond belief by stressed-out college students, but we were open to the possibility that they may have been some sort of actual occurrence behind the stories. My danger sense and a few previous encounters with things that could not be easily explained by my logic made me more likely to believe the stories, and I had long suspected that Topher had experienced something similar. Robin, of course, was whipped into a near panic every time the topic of the scary stories came up, while Nick was by far the most skeptical. "Look," Nick would say, "all these stories seem to happen around 3 a.m.
"Devil's hour,"
Robin would murmur.
"That is the problem with this campus," Nick would reply. "Everyone is so blasted emotional about their religious beliefs. They see angels in every ray of sunlight and demons in every shadow."
"Think about it, though," Topher reflected. "If there was one place on Earth the forces of darkness would be more
theatrical in their attacks, this campus would probably be it. That is irrelevant, Nick said. As I was saying, all these things happen at 3 in the morning. At that hour, even Lassie would look like Wolfman. As for the Shadow Men, hasn't anyone around here ever heard of sleep paralysis or waking dreams? This is just like Baron von Ruthless 91 and his danger sense. I just read this book, The Gift of Fear, which says that your danger sense is really just your subconscious recognizing something is off when you don't realize it yourself. There's a perfectly reasonable explanation for all of this. For most of the stories, we heard Nick could come up with a ready explanation, but his theories did not quite ease my worries about the skulls and the Aztec idol. What happened in the fall of my junior year during the semester's drama performance only compounded matters. I was in the audience with Emily. She had mentioned that she was looking forward to the play, and I had leaped at the opportunity to spend more time with her. We'd arrived at the last minute, and so we had seats in the very back of the theater. I didn't realize at the time, but the only thing separating us from the storage room and the Aztec idol was a very thin wall. The play went off without a hitch, until the very end. As the climax approached and the murderer was about to be revealed, there was a loud boom and the lights went out for a few seconds. When this occurred, everyone had their attention focused on the right side of the stage, where the detective was finally confronting the fiendish killer, and so there was no one looking at the aisles of the theater. Well, no one except for me, that is. You see, Emily was sitting directly to my left, and I'd taken the rare opportunity that the darkened theater provided to admire the freckles around her nose, something I would not have dared to do in the light of day, or if her attention were not focused elsewhere. Yeah, I know, I was on the heels of love. Sue me. Anyhow, as the lights came back on, I was the only one to see them. 4 small round shapes seemed to skitter up and down the aisle for a second before disappearing. I could have sworn that I heard the very faint sound coming from the shapes. Click-clack, click-clack. Instantly, any thoughts of Emily were forgotten. I had a sneaky feeling as to what those 4 shapes were, and I was not about to mess with them. Behind me, I heard a strange sound. A sound that can only be described as what would happen if Darth Vader were to spend a lifetime chain-smoking. Whatever that sound was, it seemed to take the form of a chuckle. It was at this point that I remembered that I was sitting against the wall. At the same time, I remembered what was on the other side of that wall. The realization made me practically leap out of my seat with a very unmanly squeak. Emily gave me a curious look, and I tried to settle down for the remainder of the play. As we left that evening, I noticed that the skulls were not in their cases. I began to have a small asthma attack when I noticed this fact. Emily noticed the source of my discomfort. "Huh," she remarked. "I must be cleaning them." I discussed the matter with my friends when I got back to the dorm that night. Robin was all for calling in an exorcist on the spot, while Topher was all for booby-trapping the basement to capture the roaming skulls. Nick put the matter down to a combination of an electric malfunction and the overactive imagination of an English major, which he was very familiar with. He also suggested that it could have been a prank. I replied that if it had been a prank, it had failed miserably. I'd been the only one to notice what had happened. Ironically, the more immediate source of my peril was to come from a far more mundane source. As my college career progressed, I began to involve myself in various service projects that the university offered. One of these service projects involved us visiting the local homeless citizens in the inner city next to our campus. I initially got involved with this service in order to fulfill some community service requirements for a class, but the people I was visiting slowly but surely grew on me. I enjoyed hearing the crazy stories that the old veterans told and helping the men and women that had young children handle their kids. For once, my experiences with my younger siblings proved to be useful. Overall, the homeless population were a lovable, if eccentric, bunch. Well, all of them except for Aiden. Aiden was an odd kid. He was about 17, maybe 18 years old, and I never heard him speak above a whisper in all my time at the homeless shelter. He'd spend his time sitting in the main room, watching and doing little else.
One day, I convinced Emily to come with me, and she went right up to Aiden and began to chatter away. I did not like the predatory look in Aiden's eyes when he looked at her, and I moved Emily to another part of the room as quickly as I could. After this incident, he fixated on me. Apparently, he saw me as a threat to whatever he imagined himself doing to Emily. He would sit in the corner of the room, muttering to himself and watching me. Nick had very good hearing, and he came with me to the shelter on one occasion. He swore that Aiden was not muttering in English, but in Latin. This was not reassuring. I began to notice Aiden on campus when there were no earthly reasons for him to be there. I saw him duck behind a pillar as I left one of my night classes, and I once saw him standing around the student center vending machines on a foggy morning. And then he disappeared completely. Just as suddenly as it began, the stalking stopped. It was as if Aiden had vanished off the face of the earth. Around this time, Robin began to have night terrors. He would claim that he'd wake up in the middle of the night and look out of our window to see shadow men watching from the lines of the trees just behind our dorm. As time passed, the apparitions began to show up inside the dorm. Robin swore up and down that he would hear the shadowy figures whispering outside his door and trying the door handle to see if it was unlocked. Thankfully for Robin's peace of mind, I was his roommate at the time and had long made it a habit to lock our door at night, even though our campus had an almost non-existent crime rate. Topher had taken to setting up elaborate ways to show Robin that his visions were just vivid nightmares, by spreading flour outside our door and having Robin place a stack of soda cans on top of the inside of our door handle so that they would fall if the handle were to be fiddled with. This was a source of great annoyance to our RA, and eventually the shadow men stopped visiting. None of the alarms were tripped, except for one time the soda cans fell off the handle at 3 a.m, which nearly gave me and Robin a panic attack. We checked the flour, but it was as smooth as ever. None of us thought that the shadow men might have been able to lean over the flower, but we didn't suspect a great many things until too late. I would have brushed the incident aside completely if it hadn't been for what Nick had heard that night. He'd been having a bout of insomnia and had been awake to hear the can fall down in the next room. Shortly after this happened, he thought he heard the front door to our dorm slam shut as if someone was leaving in a hurry. He used this fact to try and reassure us, and I suspect himself. After all, shadow men don't need doors. The event regarding my being stalked by Aiden occurred at the very end of my junior year, and Robin's sinister visitors began to make themselves known early in our senior year. By Halloween, which also happened to be our fall break, matters had calmed considerably. The shadow men had seemingly given up their campaign against my roommate, much to everyone's relief. I had other things on my mind at any rate. After 3 long years, I was finally psyching myself up to officially ask Emily out on a date. And this was a far greater source of fear to me than Aiden or even the Aztec idol and its skull minions. I planned to make my move on the night before Halloween, which was our first night off for fall break. It happened we were both staying on campus for the break, so we had a bit more privacy than usual. We'd arranged to study together at 9 o'clock that evening in a study lounge on the top floor of Edward Hall. With a good amount of teasing from Nick and Topher, Robin had gone home for the break. I left for the big event. The plan was for me to walk Emily back to her dorm after the study session and ask her out there. Things did not go entirely as planned, however. We'd been going over our notes on one of Shakespeare's play for about an hour when Emily got a text from her roommate. Apparently, she had cut herself pretty bad and required stitches and a ride to the hospital. I saw the opportunity to be the knight in shining armor and offered to drive them to the hospital. As we walked down the steps toward the parking lot behind Edward, I briefly saw movement, as if someone had just ducked inside a vacant classroom. And I thought nothing of it at the time. Emily and I stayed in the waiting room of the hospital for several hours while her friend was being tended to. As she sat next to me, Emily began to fall asleep, and she laid her head on my shoulder. This monumentous event drove my danger sense straight out of my mind, even though it had been twitching for several hours by this point. The shadow glimpsed inside of Edward weighed heavily on my subconscious, although I did not realize it at that point. About 2 a.m, Emily's friend was done with her medical emergency, but the doctors wanted to keep her overnight. Apparently, the injury was slightly more severe than we had realized. I walked Emily back to her dorm, and as we walked from the parking lot to the residence halls, she very casually let her hand brush against mine once or twice. As we reached our destination, she turned and gave me a quick kiss on the cheek before telling me good night and that she'd see me in the morning. As I reached my room, I got a text from Emily. In the confusion of the hospital visit, we left our textbooks at Edward's, and she told me that she was going to go back to get them. At this moment, my danger sense returned with a vengeance, and I remembered the figure I thought that I'd seen hiding in the vacant classroom. We had to get those books back, as I was afraid that some goofball would steal them. The bookstore charged $400 for that Shakespeare collection, and I was not about to let it go to waste. I realized that this was the setup for a bad horror movie. I'm not entirely stupid, and so I recruited Nick and Topher to assist me in my mission. I had no intention of letting Emily wander around that building in the dark by herself. Topher was enthusiastic and insisted on packing a super soaker filled with holy water to fight off the shadow men. Nick was more exasperated, but he saw something in my eyes that made him refrain from making any sarcastic comments when he agreed to come along. A large bank of fog had rolled in when we reached Edward. The building was supposed to be locked up at 11, and it was now close to 3, but Topher knew of a back door the security guards usually forgot to lock. Tonight was no exception, and after meeting Emily, we slipped quietly into the basement of Edward. Thankfully, we were on the other side of the building from the theater, so I convinced myself we did not need to worry about the Aztec idol, although the wolf creature weighed heavily on my thoughts as we ascended the staircase. We didn't know if there were any security guards roaming the building, so we didn't want to risk the noisy elevator. We reached the study lounge on the top floor and found our books. At this point, Topher's digestive system began to demand his immediate attention, and so the rest of us waited outside the restroom while he took care of business. At this point, I heard the sound. Click-clack, click-clack, coming from around a corner about 50 feet down the hall. I nearly jumped out of my skin, and Nick noticed my reaction. He'd heard the same thing as well. But he had not had my experience with the Aztec idol and the skulls, so he was slightly more brave about the situation than I was. After a whispered argument, Nick decided to poke his head up around the corner and see what was up, while Emily and I waited. Emily also did not share my fear of the skulls. Her optimism refused to let her contemplate the existence of such things. I agreed as long as Nick promised not to leave my field of vision. As Nick slipped down the hall, he had to pass one of the darkened classrooms. As he passed it, he quickly glanced inside. When he looked inside, he stopped in his tracks for about 5 seconds and peered into the room as if he'd seen something through the window. He shook his head and went on. My danger sense was screaming as he reached the corner and looked around it. He looked back at me and shook his head. There was nothing there. At this point, the door to the classroom silently opened. Nick and I stood frozen in shock as the room loomed like the jaws of some giant creature between us. For what was probably only half a minute, but felt like hours, everything was silent and motionless. And then from the room came a soft giggling sound and murmured Latin phrases. Aiden stepped out of the room and turned toward Emily, and with a huge grin on his face. I'd never seen him smile before, and I realized that for some unknowable reason, he'd mutilated his teeth so that they resembled fangs. Far more worrisome than Aiden's teeth was the long knife that he held in his hands. For several seconds, all was silent again, and then all hell broke loose. I finally regained control of my muscles and vocal cords, and I screamed at Nick to run. I hoped that this scream would alert Topher into the bathroom, and that he would have enough sense to stay quiet. Nick vanished around the corner, and I sprinted with Emily for the staircase at the far end of the hall. As I turned to go down the stairs, I caught a glimpse of Aiden moving down the hall. He was in no hurry. I'd been running as fast as I could, but Aiden seemed to be moving at a light jog, still with that horrific grin. Despite his relaxed pace, he was gaining on me. I sped down the stairs so fast that I almost tripped and very nearly pushed Emily down the final flight. Finally, we reached the bottom of the staircase, and I ducked into the first door that I saw, pulling Emily with me. The room was pitch black, and I dared not to search for a light switch. So I had no idea where I was until I bumped into the first row of chairs. We were in the theater. I heard our pursuer enter the room, so I quickly ducked behind the furthest row of seats and began to pray as I had never prayed before, and whispered to Emily that she should hide in a row behind me. I heard Naden talking to himself in his usual Latin whispers. Apparently he could not find the light switch and was not completely sure that I'd sought refuge in here. Emily was of the opinion that we would appeal to his better nature, but I did not share her optimism, and I frantically tried to keep her from talking too loud and revealing us. As our hunter prowled ever closer, I heard the very soft shuffling sound from behind me. I put it down to an overactive imagination until I heard a distinctive click-clack right beside my ear. I involuntarily leaped to my feet just as all of the lights in the room came on at once, revealing us to Aiden. Apparently, the Aztec idol could make the lights turn off on a whim, and it could also turn them on again. Aiden saw me immediately, and I saw no choice but to make for the main exit. I blew through the door like a bat out of hell, with Emily close behind, when I tripped. As I fell, I heard the door to the storage room slide open. Emily saw the storage room and ducked inside before I could stop her. She had no fear of the Aztec idol, while her bubbly cheerfulness had finally given way to common sense when it came to Aiden. Lying on the floor, I quickly rolled underneath the nearby ticket table and tried to psych myself up for what I had to do. I braced myself. If I was found by either one of my nightmares, I had no intention of going down without a fight. I heard the deep chuckle from the storage room at the same time as I heard the set of soft feet leave the theater. My thoughts began to wander. I wondered if Topher and Nick had escaped. If they had, and I died in here, they would never be able to forgive themselves. I thought of Robin. If I were to die under these circumstances, something told me that his mental state would completely snap. I thought of Emily, and I regretted that we were about to die just as she was starting to like me. I thought of my siblings and how much they would miss their big brother and how much my parents would be devastated. The thoughts of my loved one gave me courage, and I prepared for my end. At this point, something happened that I did not expect. The author J.R.R. Tolkien would have referred to this as a eucatastrophe, an undeserved coincidence that saved the day when all seems lost. As Aiden reached the desk I was hiding under, something inside the storage closet shuffled. Aiden stopped and listened for a few seconds, and then with a soft giggle, he vanished into the storage closet in search of prey. I followed him as quietly as I could. I could not have lived with myself if I had let one of the people I cared for the most in the world to be killed by a monster. I entered the closet and heard the muffled sob directly to my left. Emily had hidden just behind the door, and Aiden had walked past her in the dark. I quickly let Emily know that it was me and that we silently moved into the hallway. We were barely outside the room when the door slammed shut with an almighty crash. We made for the stairs as fast as we could. As we passed the display case, I noticed the skulls were missing again. As we reached the top of the stairs, I thought I heard a very faint muffled scream from the basement, but this may have been my imagination. We made it to the door without issue, and found Topher and Nick waiting for us along with the security guard. It took them a long time to make sense of our stories. I wisely decided the whole situation would be more plausible if I left out the Aztec god and made it out that we slipped away from the Aiden in the darkness of the storage closet. The security guard decided to call for backup and deal with the intruder, and dawn was breaking as a SWAT team entered the building. Aiden was caught on camera entering the building and had a reputation for weirdness, so the officers were prone to believe our story. They found nothing. There was no sign of Aiden or the Aztec idol. Once again, my pursuer had vanished from the face of the earth, this time for good. Nick, Topher, and I still talk about that night sometimes, although we've decided to only tell Robin an edited version of the events. Nick is of the belief that Aiden stole the idol and escaped through some sort of trap door or ventilation shaft. The room was right next to the theater, after all. But I'm not so sure. Part of me accepts Nick's story. It does make a certain amount of sense, but part of me can't help but wonder if the genie had finally found a way out of the lamp. Emily and I have been dating for several months now, and I'm looking forward to introducing her to my family next weekend. The skulls still reside in that darkened hallway, and it seems that the university has had a donation. Where there were formerly four skulls in the display case glaring at me as I pass, there are now five. For as long as I can remember, I've seen ghosts. Okay, well, that's not entirely true, but I do have vivid hallucinations practically every night. My logical mind completely understands that the objects and creatures I see are just a manifestation of my weary mind having just awakened from a dream state. But my younger years found me terrified of the things I saw in the night. I've had chronic insomnia since I was a child, so I take over-the-counter sleep aids nightly to be able to rest. These pills surely cause me to fall deeply into REM sleep, but medicated or not, I still frequently wake up in the wee hours of the morning, and that's when I see things. I've seen everything from a 5-foot penguin dancing beside my bed to a full-on Roswell alien reaching through a portal above my head. I remember one time I saw a man just sitting at my bedside where I lay with half his body inside the stereo that sat on a table at the side of my bed. By this point, I knew they were manifestations of my sleeping subconscious, so I just swatted my hand through them. It was mildly disturbing the way he just retracted backwards while staying in that hunched-over sitting position, just staring at me. Regardless of the oddness of the situation, I just rolled over and went back to sleep. I used to have crazy reoccurring dreams, too. I'm not sure if they influenced my hallucinations or not, but they were equally as strange and disturbing as some of the more unsettling images. Sure, I had plenty of falling to my death dreams or flying above the rest of the world at rest, but completely unrelated dreams would have the occasional guest star. He was like that sitcom cameo character that would always enter to the wild applause of the live audience, but not remotely as friendly and inviting. He looked like he wore a loose skin suit that was five sizes too large. It just drooped and sagged from his limbs as he shuffled toward me. He reminded me, in a way, of the guy who crashed the van into the toxic waste in RoboCop back in the day. It's possible that very movie influenced his visits in my sleeping mind, effectively transforming an innocent dream into a nightmare that I would jerk awake from. I remember one of them quite vividly. I was just walking to my car as the sun was setting, and I saw him standing a ways up the road. Though many dreams withheld memories of other night's activities, I recognized him as soon as I noticed him off in the distance. I ran to my car while he shuffled slowly toward me, and I locked the door as soon as I got in. He was still far off when I entered my vehicle, but as soon as I locked the door, he was right outside my window. He hammered his fleshy hand under the window, leaving slick trails of sweat or slime of some sort. With every pound of his loose skin, he would say, "Sleeper," in a voice that almost sounded like Boris Karloff's Frankenstein. I awoke in a cold sweat and still saw the image of the man in his wrinkled skin suit clouded in the darkness of my bedroom, though I could no longer hear his repetitious voice. His visits in my dreams would always make it hard to get back to sleep, but it's been some time since the last time I saw him. I actually hope that revisiting his memory will not set the seeds in my mind to bring a return visit tonight. Regardless of the unnerving imagery I've seen, both in my sleep and out of it, nothing has ever disturbed me more than what my half-sleep eyes showed me a few years back. All things considered, he wasn't nearly as disturbing as many of my other hallucinations, but there was just something about him that left a stain on me. Not to mention the fact that his visits became somewhat regular. Rarely do I see the same visitors more than once, aside from the saggy-skinned friend, but even he wouldn't show up as frequently. The new guy, for lack of a better term, almost resembled some sort of human-sized puppet without the side of cute and cuddly. He wore a green one-piece pajama set that appeared patterned to look like a frog. He never had the hood pulled up over his head, but I imagined to have big, circular eyes that would rest on his forehead if he did. His face was smooth and felt-like, and his closed mouth spread across his face in a wide smile that almost touched his small, half-circle ears that stuck straight out of the side of his head, sort of like how a Muppet's mouth appears. The way that were to open, it would just flap the top half of his head backward. He had a little upturned bump for a nose with wide nostrils that seemed hollowed out in the fabric of his face. His eyes were just two small dark holes with no eyebrows above them, and his short forehead cut back right above where his eyebrows would be, with no hair on top. Normally, my nighttime hallucinations appear clouded in the same darkness the rest of my bedroom holds. This one, however, had his own subtle glow that made him stand out much more vividly. The first time he showed up, I actually found him sort of cute, compared to some of my wilder imaginary late-night friends. He just stood in the far corner of my bedroom, performing a playful dance. He appeared something more inspired by a kid's show, though it had been many years since I indulged in such programs. I watched with wide and curious eyes as he silently bounced, almost clumsily. I rarely knew where the manifestations of my dream state drew the inspiration from, but some could truly be quite bizarre. Some days would pass before his second visit, and I had plenty of other oddballs inhabiting my late-night wake-up calls till then. There was a row of cartoon-like hamsters strolling across my curtain rod, a 4-foot hairless gremlin walked upright on my ceiling. He hung upside down to my view as he made his leisurely stroll. I even saw a comically ridiculous witch brewing something that formed a fine mist in her cauldron. When the 6-foot puppet reappeared on the 4th night, after our first meeting, he was closer than he was before. Now he stood in the dead center of my room, and his dance seemed to emit far less hilarity than it had before. He now swayed from side to side, allowing his arms to hang like wet noodles from his shoulders, though he had no more than small dark holes for eyes. I could feel them stare deeply into mine while he moved eerily from left to right. His head appeared almost detached, and it stayed completely still while the rest of his body wobbled. I felt a discomfort that I had not known since the earliest occurrences of my twilight visions. I turned my back to the felt-skinned figment and tried my best to ignore his presence. I still felt his cavernous eyes glaring into the back of my head while I struggled to get back to sleep. At some point, I must have managed to regain my grip on slumber as I did not wake to my intended alarm hours before I jerked back to reality. I felt dazed, as I often would when I had not achieved as much rest as my body had requested. I called my job to attempt to explain my tardiness, and my supervisor recommended that I just take the rest of the day off and we'll chalk it up to a sick day. He was a good guy overall. He's one of those rare management types that actually seems to care for his employees. Some of my bosses at previous job would likely have called me a no-call no-show and happily given me the boot. I can't say I was upset about the surprise day off, especially right before the weekend, but I thought it would be best if I sought out a new sleep aid. Perhaps my body was becoming immune to the one I'd used for the better part of a decade. I returned to my home some 4 hours after heading out to find a new sleeping agent. I checked a couple of local pharmacies to get a variety of opinions on the subject. The first recommended a simple melatonin, which I almost immediately ignored as I had tried them before to find they had little effect on me. The next suggested a liquid form of the gel caps I already used, which I was unsure about. Surely the same medication would have little difference regardless of the intake method. I did purchase a bottle anyway. If nothing else, maybe it would kick in faster than having to await the pill's disintegration while they bobbed around in my stomach acid. I even grabbed a bigger bottle of my normal method, with the intention of simply upping the dosage of chugging them made no difference. I walked to the aisles of a few other stores, more aimlessly wandering than anything else. I wasn't actively seeking anything in particular. I just felt the urge to kill a little time before heading back home. I hit up a local liquor store on my drive back to see if perhaps a little tequila would assist my pursuit of a full night's rest. If not, the 12-pack of Heinies may nudge it in the right direction. Not the most exciting way to spend my unexpected free day, but the rough sleep of the night before still left me feeling quite groggy and highly unmotivated. Around an hour later, my fresh and deliciously scented Supreme Pizza arrived. I paused the horror anthology movie that had secured my interest before I answered the door to receive my tasty award. Perhaps the series of twisted tales of terror I continued to watch after I sat back down to enjoy the meal was not the best choice for one who sought an insomnia-free sleeping experience. Regardless, I was a fan of the genre and had rarely had nightmares inspired by the viewing of such things, even as a child. It's not that I've never been chased around an abandoned summer camp by an axe-wielding hockey mask zombie in the occasional dream. I just didn't particularly see them as nightmares. It would be that my sleeping mind knew these were merely fabrications of my subconscious and saw no reason to jerk myself back to the land of the living on account of them. I took a deep swig of my new sleep-inducing concoction and finished the third and final beer of the night. Though I knew I'd have no trouble falling asleep, even without the meds, I was well aware that if I neglected to take them, I would likely be awake again within a few hours. I cut the TV off, sending the anthology of screams to rest for the night as I raised from my couch to follow suit.
"Well, hello there,"
a high-pitched voice called through the night, forcing my dormant eyes to spring open. The puppet man in the frog onesie was staring directly at my face when I awoke. He was crouched on the floor right beside my bed with his head at a slight tilt.
"I didn't even see you there," he exclaimed.
His voice sounded similar to that of the famous Disney Mouse, if he had been a pack-a-day smoker for 40 years anyway. It was high-pitched but scratchy.
"Do you want to be friends?"
he asked as his head flopped over to the other side of the tilt. His mouth, sure enough, flapped around the top of his head like a Muppet. I could even see what looked like the impression of the puppeteer's fingers pressed under the felt on the top side of the mouth. I felt stunned and somewhat perplexed by the inclusion of speaking with my new twilight visitor. I've seen some crazy shit in the wee hours of the morning, but they never uttered sound before. Even the alien that reached through the swirling vortex above my bed did so without the slightest hint of anything audible. I'd already become a bit freaked out by the movements of this most recent creation of my weary mind, but now I was growing downright scared.
"Well," his squeal of a voice continued, "what do you say?"
I rolled over and attempted to force my eyes shut again. The most interaction I'd ever given these hallucinations was a sleepy swat through the air. I considered doing the same with the one that now crouched at my bedside, but I didn't want to encourage whatever was causing my hallucinations to, I don't know, evolve. They'd never spoken before. What's next?
"Okay, sleepyhead," the voice echoed behind my head. "I'll leave you alone. Sweet dreams."
He finished with a high-pitched laugh before he tussled my hair with his four-fingered mitt for a hand. With that, I jerked around and leapt from my bed. I turned the light on to be greeted with nothing more foul than my dirty clothes-laden laundry hamper. "What the fuck?" I said out loud while gasping for breath. My hands were shaking and my back was tensed up so much it felt like an iron rod. I proceeded to lift up my sheets to check under my bed and swung the closet door open before leafing through the clothes that hung inside in search of any sign of a late-night intruder. I headed out of my bedroom and back downstairs to perch upon my couch. There's no way I'd be sleeping in my bed for the remainder of my night. My thoughts reeled from the figments of making physical contact with me, but the rational side of my brain was already hard at work trying to ease my panic. It had to be something else that just gave me the impression of touch, right? Maybe the pillow was more fluffed on its upper side than the section I'd laid my head on. I may have just inadvertently brushed against it while adjusting my posture. That is as far more likely than a felt-handed creature of the night rubbing my noggin. After cleaning off a few more beers, I decided to attempt to sleep off the strange events my tired mind produced. Refusing to re-enter my bedroom for the remainder of the night, I grabbed one of my coats from the rack to the side of my front door. I wrapped it around myself and curled up on the couch, leaving the lights on like a nervous child with night terrors. Sure, I wasn't actually proud of the way I was acting at the moment, but the rational portion of my brain had not convinced me of the innocent misunderstandings of things as much as I would have liked to. After a good hour of tossing and turning, I finally felt myself doze off for the second time that night. I slept in again, but Saturday did not require me to awaken at a specific time, so no harm done there. I felt far more rested than I did the previous day, so I thought I may actually try to accomplish something with my responsibility-free weekend. I heard and felt my bones creak and crack while I stretched my arms out, accompanied by a long and heavy yawn. On the way to the bathroom to begin the day with a refreshing shower, I peeked through my bedroom door. Nothing was out of place, and no strange visitors crouched on the floor beside my queen-sized bed. Feeling my sanity adjusting back to its default setting, I continued my quest for showery goodness. I was never a particularly vain individual, but the litter of hair that I watched circle the drain as I turned off the flow of water to the shower made my heart sink quite a bit. My father had experienced early baldness, and I'd never known him to have much hair aside from the evidence shown in photographs from his youth. I suppose that it was bound to happen eventually as I ran my fingers through my hair in the bathroom mirror. I hadn't really noticed the onset of baldness before that day, but I was rarely prone to pay much attention to my own reflection. I was never a fan of the idea of being that guy with the wrap around the back hairline, so, with a heavy sigh, I dug my hair clippers out of the drawer to my left and buzzed the remaining dark hair away. I couldn't have predicted that I'd be rocking the head stubble and hat at the tender age of 23, but at least it was a more commonplace look in the current times. I always had a naturally dark complexion and fairly thick eyebrows, so it wasn't as bad as I expected. I made my way out of my home while placing some phone calls to meet up with some friends I hadn't seen in a few months. Truthfully, I just wanted to spend some time with some actual physical people while maybe getting an idea of how ridiculous I looked now. Maddie and Quincy, who I'd been tight with since high school, wasted no time in mocking my new appearance. Sure, they were apt to make fun of anything that struck their fancy on a regular basis, but they assured me it was all in good fun. We spent the rest of the day catching up and reflecting on the times gone by. We were always pretty tight, and they were among the few that I had told about my strange hallucinations in the night. Since they were already familiar with these things, I decided to tell them about my more recent unusual visitations. Quincy was taking some online psychology courses, so he advised that I may be dealing with manifestations of some childhood trauma or something of that nature. Maddie just indicated that I may be a full-on cuckoo bird and that I should stop watching stupid movies before bed. I actually took more offense to him calling horror movies stupid than him insinuating I was batshit. It's not like we hadn't called each other far worse things over the years. I can't say I had any recollection of childhood traumas, but Quincy said that that's the nature of repression and manifestation. Maddie just laughed and offered, "Dude, you've been taking those classes for, what, a year now? You really think you're ready to be giving anyone a goddamn diagnosis?" Quincy simply replied, "Hey, ask for our opinions, right?" As the hours grew closer to midnight, my friends and I said our goodbyes and made our separate ways. It was good to see the two of them again. Though it had been only months since our last meeting, it seemed like so much longer. Quincy's words had caused me to ponder my personal history a bit, and I planned to take a drive to my parents' house the following day. Perhaps they could shine some light on anything in my past that could have led to the strange occurrences that interrupted my sleep of late. By the time I reached my home, I was feeling quite exhausted and ready to attempt another night's rest. I chugged from my bottle of liquid slumber medication after snapping the deadbolt to my front door shut. I briefly considered climbing into my bed, but opted for snatching my blanket and pillows to carry them down to my couch. It was completely irrational, I knew that, but I had not experienced any reemergence of the felt-faced puppet man after retiring to the comfort of my sofa. Could this particular hallucination be unable to traverse a small staircase? It was unlikely, but sleeping downstairs provided the best sleep I'd had in some time. Best to stick with what works. So I curled up under the safety of my thick blanket and let my eyes fall shut.
What you doing all the way down here?
The high-pitched tones cried out, causing another full night of rest to slip out of grasp again. He sat with his legs folded across each other on the center of my coffee table in front of the couch. He was twiddling his thick and cushioned thumb while his little dark holes glared at me from his head that hung to the side. I'd left the light on when I passed out earlier. I knew that much, but the room lay dark now. The only light was provided by the tall street lamps outside that shed their glow through my thin curtains. He still sported his own subtle illumination, but there was something slightly different about his appearance now. I sat straight up, which brought us to gaze at each other truly face to face for the first time. I could barely convince my lungs to expand and contract while I looked into the fabric facsimile of his face. Though his mouth was just a Pac-Man-like connection of two halves of an ovular circle, it seemed to form an unsettling smile. His shoulders jumped as he let out a single giggle while we shared our staring contest.
"Don't you want to talk to me?"
he said, spreading his arms out as if to introduce himself. I slowly shook my head from side to side in response to his question, though I did not take my eyes off his deep, dark cutouts.
"Okay, fine then,"
he said, straightening his back and folding his arms. He turned his head to the side and jutted it upward like a pouting child. It was then I noticed what was different about his appearance. Thick, dark hair now sprouted from his previously bald felt scalp. It almost formed a mohawk that protruded from the tip of his short head and traveled back to where his neck met the frog-eyed hood. I rubbed my now stubbled head while not allowing the thoughts that echoed from the recesses of my mind to take full form. He turned back to me and leaned in toward me. He propped his elbows on the top of his knees and leaned his soft lower jaw upon his mitts.
"Why don't you want to be friends?"
he asked, with the fabric above his eye holes forming a light frown. He gave a heavy sigh that sent a foul stench of mothballed and decayed old clothing into my face. I almost gagged before he leaned in closer and bounced an outstretched plush finger off my nose with a boop, which followed with a giggle. I don't remember going back to sleep that night, but I woke on my sofa a little after noon. I felt a little drained, but no more so than some of my uninterrupted slumbers in the past. Perhaps I just dreamed this particular appearance of my fuzzy-faced visitor. He'd been preying heavily on my thoughts these past few days. After investigating the wide wooden table across from the couch, I found nothing out of place. The empty beer can from the night before still sat on the stained circular coaster. The box of tissues that I purchased earlier in the year to combat my seasonal allergies still lay in the center of the table. Shrugging this event off as a product of my own overactive imagination, I started my trek up the stairs for my daily shower. I called my mom to be sure that she and my dad would be at the house before I started out on the 45-minute drive to reach my childhood home. She sounded quite giddy at the news of my visit, which caused me a flash of guilt as it had been far too long since I last saw them in person. There had been plenty of phone calls, text messages, and emails, but I never seemed to find the time to share their company. They were loving and attentive parents, but they respected the space that a young adult required after moving out of the home they grew up in. Still, I really should try to spend more time with them. As soon as I stepped through the door, my mother wrapped her arms around me. My father just clapped me on the shoulder with his outstretched arm and greeted me with a sincere, "It's good to see you, kiddo." Once upon a time, I would have scowled at my dad for referring to me as a kid, but I couldn't help but become immersed in the nostalgia of being back here after too much time away. My mom quickly let me go to scamper into the kitchen to attend to the cookies she started baking after my call. This caught me off guard at first, as I used to bask in the scent of my mother's baking as a child. I hadn't noticed any sort of appetizing smell when I entered the house my folks had owned for years before I came along. Moments after my mom had fled to the kitchen, she came strolling back and sporting twin oven mitts and a steaming tray of chocolate chip cookies. She would never lower herself to using the canned dough to prepare such a treat. She mixed them by hand, and they tasted so much more delightful than any prepackaged snack you'd find at your local grocery store. Though I still couldn't so much as pick up a whiff of the tasty goodness the now cooling stove had produced, my mouth watered in anticipation. "They're still really hot," my mom said proudly as she sat the tray down on the padded prop in the middle of their large dining table. She playfully smacked my hand when I extended my arm toward the steaming pan, risking certain burnt flesh in my desire to taste the delicious treat. I gave in and agreed to allow the snacks to reach a tolerable temperature before lunging at them a second time. We began the obligatory conversation to catch up on each other's lives since our last meeting. It really had been some time since we last talked like this. My mom told me about her artistic ventures while my dad bitched about his job. He'd be retiring next year, and it sounded like he was more than ready. My mother hadn't worked since she fought off cancer some years back, but she came out the other side of that battle with the urge to paint again. She always talked about how she loved to do such things when she was younger, but life took priority over her dreams. My father's job paid well enough to make life easy for them, though he despised it with a fiery passion. "Okay, go ahead," my mom said, giggling as she noticed me eyeballing the tray again. I instantly crammed the entirety of a wide, soft cookie into my mouth. Both my parents laughed at my enthusiasm, but when my mom asked, "So are they as good as you remember?" I couldn't give her an answer. As delectable as I knew my mother's baking to be, I couldn't even slightly taste it. I wasn't about to tell the woman who wore a proud smile across her face that I could not reap the benefits of her craft at the moment. I just gave her a wide grin, revealing chunks of crumbled cookie bits still in my teeth, and nodded. I decided to chalk my absent taste buds off as some sort of sinus issue. It was September, after all, and I would often have similar allergy symptoms to those I dealt with in the springtime of that year. My less rational section of my brain was insisting I reconsider my stance on this. "First, he rubbed your head and your hair fell out. Could you be the victim of a ravenous nasal boop now?" the little voice in my head questioned. I would not allow myself to entertain any such ideas at this time. I chose to silence the nagging in the back of my head and simply enjoy the company of my loving parents for a time. As I predicted, my folks couldn't shed any light on potentially traumatic events from my youth, but I was pretty certain of the fact before heading out there for the day. They did mention that I had an almost unhealthy obsession with the little stuffed frog, Bernie. Apparently, I built this toy up in my immature mind as my imaginary friend. We didn't live around many other families at the time, so I would dive into a fantastical world of my own creation with Bernie at my side. We fought pirates and evil knights with sinister agendas and even traveled the stars in a cardboard spaceship from time to time. That was until we had an apparent falling out. My mother threw open the door to my room while I was in the middle of pitching a legendary fit while tearing my beloved stuffed frog to shreds. I claimed that he had turned bad and wanted to steal my life from me while my mom grappled to hold me still. Somehow in my rage, I'd managed to carve several small gashes into my face and forearms, presumably from my fingernails. She wrapped her arms around me in an attempt to prevent me from causing myself more harm. I had no memory of the small plush animal that she showed me in our family photo albums, nor the shredding of it. I recognized my bedroom and my other toys that the picture reflected, but I had no recollection of Bernie and his big, bulging eyes. As the hour grew late, I bid my folks good night and began my journey home. I promised them I would not wait so long before coming out to see them again, and I meant every word. The day's revelations had unsettled me, but I truly did enjoy sharing my parents' company again. On my ride home, with little to occupy my mind outside of the radio, I found my thoughts wandering away from the road ahead. It wasn't until I heard the blazing horn from the headlights that were speeding toward me that I snapped out of my pensive daze. I jerked the steering wheel to the right in an effort to get back to the lane I was meant to be in. I heard the other car screaming from beside me as my overcorrection left me careening toward the trees that paralleled the road. I pulled the wheel in the opposite direction, but still slammed sideways into a thick, hefty tree. The violent collision caused my head to smash into my side window, cracking the glass and rendering me unconscious.
"Owie!"
the high-pitched voice said, awakening from my unconscious state.
"That looks like it hurts bad," he continued as he reached his soft mitt from across the compacted passenger seat.
He used a padded thumb to wipe blood from my left eye. I had no idea the extent of my injuries, but I could feel the dried blood crack when I made a wincing expression due to the pounding of my head. I adjusted my posture back to an upright position and turned to face the 6-foot puppet who currently rode shotgun in my steaming car. Since most of the damage was on the passenger side, it appeared that I had only suffered wounds inflicted by the impact itself, though my left foot had somehow jammed under the brake pedal. I tugged at it with my hands wrapped around my upper thigh, but couldn't get it free until,
"I'll help you, old buddy, old pal,"
came from the felt-faced man who sat next to me before he contorted his soft body sideways to grip my leg with his felt-flying fingers. He made exaggerated grunting sounds while he wiggled my foot back and forth, ultimately freeing it from beneath the pedal. I found myself a little surprised and somewhat intimidated by the strength those cushioned, plush hands showed.
"Thank you," I replied, still in a degree of shock, but sincerely grateful to the strange man in the frong onesie.
"No," he said as his wide mouth twisted into a wide and sinister smile.
"Thank you."
My jaw fell agape when his squeaky voice morphed into mine. It wasn't until that moment that I noticed the new addition to his face. A fleshy human nose now took the place of a small nub with a hollowed nostril that had previously sat just below his beady eye holes.
"See you later, buddy,"
he spoke through my own words before my eyes closed again. When I awoke in a hospital bed, I felt confused and lost for a moment. Over the hours that followed, the doctor informed me of my injuries, which included a deep gash across my eyebrow, a slight concussion, and an unexplainable series of bruising on my left leg. I investigated my shin to see darkened flesh in the pattern of a four-fingered hand. I stayed overnight at the doctor's recommendation and would find more troubling revelations the following day. After the bandages were removed, I still could not see anything out of my left eye. On top of that, I found myself unable to move my left leg from the knee down. They ran several tests to check for nerve damage and the like, but could come to no positive conclusion as to why my limb hung limp and lifeless. As the day progressed, my voice grew scratchy, and I'd find myself coughing whenever I attempted to speak. Again, no answers could be found to account for this ailment either. I could no longer ignore the reality of what was happening to me, though I could not convince anyone to believe my story. Over the weeks that followed, I started seeing a psychiatrist and endured a number of pointless sleep studies. The shrink prescribed me a variety of medications, as he seemed convinced my issues were psychosomatic. As the weeks led to months, I still hadn't regained my sense of smell or the sight of my left eye. I continued to walk with a limp with the aid of a cane, which was another recommendation from my doctor. I can still speak, but only for so long at a time before I start coughing as my throat grows more scratchy with every word uttered. It would be close to a year before I had another meeting with the felt-faced puppet man. It's been a while, huh? My voice uttered from beside my bed, causing the night's sleep to come to an end. I turned to face him before adjusting myself into a sitting position in my bed. He still had his unnatural glow, but now he had human lips to go with the nose he had stolen before. I noticed the left leg of his onesie was now cut short below his knee to reveal a fleshy shin and foot. His hair was longer now, almost hanging to his shoulder, and his left eye hole had been replaced by a light blue human-like eye. It didn't surprise me to see these new aspects to his appearance, as I had no misconceptions about what had truly caused the ailments I still suffered from. "What do you want now, Bernie?" I asked with a heavy sigh. "Just one last thing," he said with a wide smile spreading across his fleshy mouth. He even had a row of sparkling white teeth behind them, too. At least he wouldn't have to steal mine. "Go on, then," I replied, growing impatient at the knowledge I was about to become even more disabled than I was before I lay down that night. He clumsily walked toward the bed and reached a hand out to my right ear. He rubbed his felt hand across it before whipping a tarnished silver coin from behind it. He held out in front of me before dropping it onto the bed. "For all the trouble," he said as I felt the hearing fade from where he had brushed. A comically loud popping sound erupted from the side of his head as a fleshy ear appeared in place of the previous half-circle of felt. I picked up the coin he bounced onto my bed. I looked at it to see that it didn't look like any currency I was familiar with. I turned my gaze back to the strange mix of puppetry and human parts before me with my head tilted. "I figure it's the least I can do for all you've done for me," he replied with a chuckle that sounded like a bizarre combination of his previously high-pitched laugh and my own. "So, is this the last time?" I asked, dreading the answer. He placed his stuffed forefinger into his mouth and turned his stolen eye up to the ceiling. "Might just be," he replied, still glaring upward. He turned his head back to me and held his left arm straight out in front of him with his fingers outstretched. "Let's shake on it," he said, smiling even wider than before. "You said one last thing. You already took my fucking ear," I exclaimed, both frustrated and angry. He didn't say a word. He just stood there, frozen in place with that creepy grin. "Fuck it," I said with a heavy sigh. "At least I'm a righty," I concluded, grasping his soft hand in mine, fully expecting this to be the last time I'd be able to use those fingers. With another comically loud pop, he disappeared right before my eyes. I'd never actually seen him leave before, so maybe this would actually be the last time. It's been 2 years since that night, and I still have the use of both my hands. Sure, the left one has a tendency to lock up from time to time, and it grows steadily more painful the more I use it, but I can't complain. I still only have one good eye, one good ear, and no sense of smell, but things could be worse. The gift my fleshed and felted visitor left me with turned out to be a flowing hair, silver copper dollar, that I sold at auction for around $7.5 million, after taxes, of course. This allowed me to enjoy ample comforts to distract me from my disability, so I can't say it was a complete waste. I even had my useless leg removed and replaced with a prosthetic that is far more easy to work with than the limp chunk of flesh and bone that dangled there before. I never got answers as to who the puppet man really was or how he was able to steal from me what he did. Could he really be a product of my childhood mind who somehow found himself tangible and sentient? I highly doubt it. There's a lot of crazy shit out there, as my granddad used to say. There's no telling if I'll ever see Bernie again, or if he'll feel the need to rob me of any more of my senses if I should. I still sleep with the light on, and I still battle with insomnia, but perhaps my nightmare has actually ended. I still awaken to the sounds of high-pitched, eerie laughter from time to time, but that may just be my mind playing tricks on me. Just be aware of the shadows that play across your walls in the wee hours of the morning. You never know if there's something real hiding amongst them.